This is Warbird Radio.
Hey, it's Matt from Warbird Radio Live. Listen, if you're trying to find something special for one of your aviation buddies, visit us online at warbirdradio.com/deals. DEALS. Warbirdradio.com/deals for some great offers from aviation memorabilia. Just a cool stuff that all pilots will enjoy. You can find it at warbirdradio.com/deals. And remember, every dollar that you spend there on the deals page or even through our Amazon store, which is on the right side of the screen there, it helps keep the station on the air. And boy, every penny helps. And we certainly appreciate your business. Warbirdradio.com/deals.
Jeff Harold here from Shaden Precision Eyewear. Shaden offers unmatched headset comfort with the best in titanium and composite frames and non-polarized lenses. Eyewear for the true aviator. Visit us online now at Shaden.com. That's Scheyden.com. Again, Scheyden.com. Be sure to enter the promo code Warbird, and you're going to receive 30% off your order. Visit Shaden.com right now. Put in Warbird and get 30% off.
Our thanks to our friends at Aerospace Specialties, the industry standard for quality, craftsmanship, and precision. When it comes to handcrafted compound-formed Warbird parts, look no further than our friends at Aerospace Specialties. They've been doing this since 1971, and they're standing by now for your order. Aerospace Specialties, call them today, 304-647-5024. That's 304-647-5024.
Reminding you that radial engines don't leak oil. They just mark their territory. This is Warbird Radio. Tune in. Take off.
Welcome to the Wings Over New Zealand show with Dave Homewood.
Welcome to the Wings of New Zealand show. I'm your host, Dave Homewood, and today we're talking with Barry Nelson, better known as Patch. Hi, Patch.
Yeah, g'day, Dave. How are you getting on?
Good, good. Now, you were a Skyhawk pilot back in the day in the RNZF.
Yes, I was. I started flying Skyhawks in 1987 when I started my conversion at Number 2 Squadron.
Okay.
And then flew them right through till 1997 with a break in the middle there for a little bit of instructing on the air trainer.
Oh, right, okay. So tell me a little bit about, you know, how you found them as aircraft, what they were like to fly and you know, your general memories of the aircraft itself.
Well, I guess the thing for me is I grew up through high school in the, you know, the late 1970s, and of course the Skyhawk at that stage was the pinnacle of aviation in New Zealand, and as a young fella, pretty much always wanted to be a fighter pilot. Never wanted to be a policeman or a fireman or anything like that.
Yeah.
And so the Skyhawk was, that was the thing to aim for. And I guess I was fortunate enough to have some of the skills and some of the academic inclinations. And with a lot of hard work and that along the way, we ended up getting to a conversion middle of 87 after a period at university and a little bit of flying training.
Right, right. And of course, you would have trained on the Stripe Masters at that stage, would you?
Yeah, absolutely. I was a Blunty baby from way back. So the guys talking about Mackies and things, I had one hour in the back seat of a Mackie at one stage. All of my heart lies with the Blunty. So watching Dave Brown do his stuff over the air shows around New Zealand brings a tear to the eye for sure.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's great to see one back in the sky, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And people, you know, I guess love's in the, you know, in the eye of the beholder, but when that's your first jet type that you flew, there's definitely a little bit of passion there for it.
Yeah, yeah. I guess there must have been quite a step up going from the Blunty into the TA-4K.
Yeah, it certainly was. I think everyone remembers their first flight, just the sheer acceleration off the runway, the sensitivity of the ailerons. I think everyone tells a story of sort of getting airborne and then doing this twitch of about sort of 5 degrees either side of wing straight and level as they tried to get the ailerons, the feel for the ailerons sorted out.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, 10 minutes into it, you're just humming. It was it's an awesome aeroplane.
Okay, okay. Do you find it easy to fly?
Look, it was... Yeah, it was relatively easy to fly with some vices, and so, for instance, we found later on that after the guys had been coming through the Mackie, that the Skyhawk actually presented some vices that the Mackie didn't, and we did have a couple of fairly spectacular departures from controlled flight in the Skyhawk with guys that had become used to the relatively benign handling of the Mackie.
All right.
Having said that, if you didn't get yourself into some of those corners, it was a really fun aeroplane to fly. It was responsive. You know, you had to deal with the drag of the delta if you if you had the angle of attack too high for too long. But it was a difficult aeroplane to operate.
Right.
It was a challenging aeroplane to operate, I should say. And a lot of that is really because we just did everything, and so you just had to get good at everything, and that was, you know, from maritime strike, air combat, close air support, interdiction, you know, the tanking, close formation aeros, did it all at night, that sort of thing. So yeah, a lot of fun to fly, quite hard to operate competently.
Right, okay. So when you first converted onto them, did you go onto the newly upgraded Kahus, or were you still using the... No, it must have been still the old ones then, the 87, was it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I did my first tour on the old jet, or the dinosaur, as we called it once the Kahu jet
yep.
Came into being. In fact, I was effectively the last dinosaur line pilot. Goris delivered the last dinosaur down to Woodburn, I believe, but I was the last of the sort of the line pilots that didn't get a Kahu conversion before I headed off to instructor's course.
Oh, right.
So I did my first tour on the old jet, including the time on Kiwi Red.
Yep.
I went away, I did my instructor's course, I spent a year at PTS flying the air trainer, and then in 92 I headed over to 2 Squadron to be the ops flight commander. Except that I hadn't actually flown the Kahu jet, so the learning curve was pretty steep when I first arrived in Australia.
Right, I bet, yeah.
When you got out of the training and onto the actual squadron as such, onto 75, is it quite daunting to go into that sort of environment?
Yeah, it is, and I think a lot of people. Obviously, not too many people have a view of what happens on the squadron, and I think some have the impression that, you know, once you get your wings, you've made it, or once you've finished your fighter lead-in course, you've made it, or once you get to 75 Squadron, you've made it. But in actual fact, it never, ever stops, and the saying goes, you're only as good as your last bad word mess-up.
Yeah.
And that's true right through your whole career. And so even when you get to 75 Squadron, you're at the bottom of the pecking order. You're the small fish in a big pond. You have to prove yourself as a pilot. You have to develop your skills. You have to pass your instrument rating tests, your general handling tests, which are done on a yearly or 6-monthly basis. You have to do your op categories. So you start as an operational pilot, then you know, within a year, you're expected to upgrade to be a 2-ship lead. Within 2 years, you're expected to upgrade to a 4-ship lead.
Yeah.
When you come back as a flight commander or the boss, you're expected to be able to lead what we would call a guerrilla, or more than 4 aircraft.
Okay.
Integrating different aircraft types, tankers, electronic warfare, all of that sort of thing. So the scrutiny on your performance never ever stops, and I guess that was really one of the drivers for the professionalism that I think, you know, all of the pilots that I was involved with tried to show on the squadron, because everyone was aware that you drop the ball and you look like an ass, and no one wants to do that.
Right. Actually, it's really interesting to hear that, because you know, everybody's aware of the high professionalism that our strike pilots had, but I guess the general view is once they got into 75 Squadron, they'd made it, and there was sort of all just fun from there. But yeah, it's quite interesting actually.
Yeah, not at all. No, the guys and everyone without exception that I knew worked really hard, because credibility is fleeting, and like any good performer, and you know, we've seen some spectacular disasters on stage or at the Super Bowl or whatever, where you get a, you know, long established, you know, well respected performer, they drop the ball and, you know, they're only as good as their last mess up. So
yep.
It's the same sort of thing really. You need to be on the ball all the time, and of course if you drop the ball in an A4, potentially you could hit something or someone, and that's it, all over.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. So you also had a lot of quite hard case characters in your time in the squadrons then, didn't you?
Yeah, look, everyone's different, and it's amazing when you, if anyone's read the book The Right Stuff, you know, what is the right stuff, what separates the men from the boys, what makes, you know, a good fighter pilot from an average one, from someone who, you know, never quite makes it that far. It's really hard to tell, because when you're on the squadron, you know, you have your exuberant characters, you have your quiet characters, you have your, you know, some guys are a lot of fun, some guys take it really seriously.
Yeah.
There are all sorts, even within that sort of microcosm of a bunch of guys who have all come to what in New Zealand was a very small community. And, of course, variety is the spice of life. And so, you know, if you're all the same, it'd be really boring, and for sure no one was the same.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess over those 10 years of flying the Skyhawks, you must have had some fairly interesting exercises overseas.
Yeah, we did. We got around a lot, and I guess the main ones were the deployments up into Southeast Asia in support of the five-power defence arrangement. And so once a year, 75 Squadron would deploy up into Southeast Asia, and that would involve normally a trip to either Singapore or Malaysia.
Yep.
And normally we would alternate that year by year. And then in conjunction with that, sometimes the guys would go up into Thailand in conjunction with that exercise.
Okay.
And on one of the times that I was on the squadron, we actually deployed up through Indonesia, and we flew out of Medan in Indonesia for, I think it was 10 or 12 days with the Indonesian Air Force.
Wow, that was
really, really interesting.
Yeah, it would be, yeah.
Yeah. I was lucky enough to get on a deployment where we went up into Thailand and worked with the Thais.
Yep.
And on one of the deployments up into Malaysia, exercise Flying Fish in 97, at that stage it was the biggest exercise that had been held in the area since the Second World War. And so we had something in the order of 100 fast jets from the UK, Australia, New Zealand, Singapore and Malaysia. We had the E3D, AWACS, the VC 101 tanker, or the VC-10 tanker from 101 Squadron, sorry,
yep.
Out from the UK, as well as the HMS Illustrious with the FA-2 Sea Harriers.
Oh, wow.
So you had Aussie F-18s and F-111s, you had Singaporean F-16s, F-5s, A-4s, the Malaysians had MiG-29, F-5, etc. So it was really quite the exercise.
Oh, absolutely! Wow, that sounds amazing. Sounds awesome.
Yeah, we also actually had the RAF Tornadoes out as well. So you had the GR1 guys doing strike and the F3 guys doing air defence.
Okay.
And I guess the highlight of my career actually was on that exercise where basically what we'd do is normally the Kiwis would play red air, and so we would be the attackers. We would go out and we would strike against the fleet of ships that were normally out off the east coast of Malaysia.
Yes, yeah.
In the exercise areas there. And then we would also do strikes against mainland Singapore and at the airfields at Kuantan and Penang on Malaysia.
Right.
And the way they organised it, basically there would be very sort of narrow boxes, so sort of 30 miles wide and 50 miles long sort of thing, where a pair of fighters would conduct a combat air patrol and call out a kill box, and then as strikers, so I'd take a four ship of A4s,
yeah,
and we would have to flow through that kill box.
Okay, yeah.
And therefore, you're sort of pretty much guaranteed that the fighters are going to get a radar contact, they're going to have to fly an intercept, you're going to have to defend yourself against them, and then once you go through the kill box, you pop out the other side, and there's the ships or one of the land targets or whatever. Now, some of these missions involved up to sort of six kill boxes. So, for instance, we might get airborne out of Kuantan,
yeah,
on the east coast of Malaysia, go out to the north, turn out to the east over the water,
yeah,
and fly in through a kill box, attack the ships, fly out through a kill box, go down to Singapore, fly in through a kill box, attack a target on Singapore, fly out through a kill box, go to the tanker, get some more gas, fly up to the north of Malaysia, go in through a kill box, attack the airfield at Penang, go out through a kill box, and then recover back to Kuantan.
Wow.
So you're talking about a single mission that was 2.5-3 hours long with six kill boxes, what, three or four targets and a tanking serial.
Wow.
And it was kind of cool.
Yeah, it would have been. And I guess each of those kill boxes must have had a different type of aircraft in them.
Absolutely. And so yep, all the fighter guys, the people practicing to defend Peninsula Malaysia, they got to defend the kill boxes.
Yeah.
And so we would run up against Aussie F-18s or Singaporean F-16s or the Malaysian Hawk 200s or MiG-29s. And in this, the one case that is most memorable, the coming off the ships the first time, the kill box was patrolled by two RAF Tornado F-3 fighters.
Yes.
And I was leading a four-ship of A-4s with three jugs. So three drop tanks,
yeah,
an AIM-9 captive missile, an AGM-65 captive missile, and that's about as heavy and as draggy as it gets. It was early in the sortie, so there wasn't a lot of maneuverability available in the jet. And effectively, the two F-3s saw us and committed on us.
Yeah.
And fortunately, the Australians over the years had taught us an awful lot about defeating the radar missile. So the Tornado F-3 was armed with the Sparrow missile.
Yep.
And so split to pairs, conducted a radar missile defense to the merge, and basically I ended up getting a guns kill on the F-3 that had come down to attack our pair.
Wow.
And my number three, Anthony Fraser, but he took a Fox 2 kill on his guy, and so first merge of the war, really, with the RAF boys, and it was 2-0 with the Kiwis.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, and then what made it really sweet was the fact that the guy leading the pair was a guy I'd met on an electronic warfare course in the UK
yep,
some years before. And so when we did the phone debrief, it was kind of cool because we remade our acquaintances and yeah, then got to talk about how the flow had gone, and they were just blown away that we had done that to them.
Okay, wow.
It was kind of a sweet moment.
Wow, so those exercises were really, really crucial for that dissimilar combat training, weren't they, really?
Yeah, so it's one of those things that, you know, some people used to ask why we did air combat, because, you know, we weren't dedicated fighter aircraft. Most of our roles were really dedicated to maritime strike or close air support and that sort of thing. But
yep,
I think, you know, here's a classic example where you've got an ugly aeroplane in that it's carrying an awful lot of stuff, it's heavy, it's not as maneuverable as normal,
yeah,
and you are required to strike progress, you need to evade some fighter aircraft to actually get to where you want to go. And so those skills of conducting your combat and flying the aeroplane in a less than optimum configuration, you know, suddenly they all come to the fore in actually what was a very realistic scenario where, you know, potentially we're carrying a lot of weaponry, we need to go places, because obviously as soon as you jettison your weapons,
yeah,
well, that's a kill as far as the defending fighters are concerned anyway.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me about when you got selected for a Kiwi Red.
Yeah, so that was not yesterday either. So basically, as I said, I joined the squadron in January 88. And so, of course, through 1987 and 1988, there were also Kiwi Red teams run by Frank Sharp.
Yep.
And they had done a number of displays, had been over to the Australian Bicentennial and things like that. So there wasn't a lot of flying, to be fair, for the guys that weren't on the team
yep.
in that sort of period. And so then sort of 89-90 came along, and John Bates had taken over as the CO. And the Commonwealth Games were coming up in Auckland. And a number of people had commented that we'd had these Kiwi Red teams in 87, 88, or might have been even 86, 87, 88, but they hadn't really displayed that much in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And so the idea came about that we would do a bit of a national tour, and then that would be finished off by displays at the opening and closing of the Commonwealth Games.
Right, right, and okay.
So in, I think, the sort of September, August, September 89 timeframe, we started working up and then went through and finished off effectively in the, I think it was the March, April of 90, so following the Commonwealth Games.
Right. Right.
And a few of the summer air shows like Ardmore, which I see is on YouTube.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was at that show. I also saw the team in Hamilton as well, I think,
yeah,
twice.
That was a memorable show because there were two shows. There was, even Ardmore, we flew home after the show, so didn't really get to see much of the crowd.
Yeah.
But Hamilton and Invercargill were two shows where we were based out of those airfields. We took off from the airfield with the crowd there, did the display, and then actually landed back.
Right.
And had the experience of meeting the crowd afterwards, because for most of our other displays, we based out of Ahakia or Whenuapai or Harewood.
Yep.
And then flew off to the display and came home, and you literally, it was just like going to work. You go and do a display, you land back and, you know, sign the jet in, say good day to the groundies and go and have a beer, and that was, it was like any other day at work. Whereas
right.
Hamilton and Invercargill were quite quite special because we were right in amongst it when we landed back. There were fans aplenty, lots of babies to kiss, lots of signatures to sign, and it was kind of a neat experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, actually, I do remember you guys parking up all the jets there at Hamilton, and the crowd getting to have a pretty close look at the aircraft, and there was a lot of groundies there that were selling hats and that sort of thing as well. It was great.
Yep, the squadron fund did pretty well out of a couple of thousand.
Yeah, I got one of those hats.
Yep, I think I've got one somewhere still too.
So what was your position and your specialty within the team?
Within the team itself, I was the number two.
Yep.
And really, specialty-wise, was just being smooth the whole time, because normally I'd have Pete King outside me trying to look through me at the boss, and basically my job was not to distract him.
Yeah.
And that was about it, really. Dobbo and I, as Dobbo was Red 3, we would do the rollbacks. So that was a pair's effort, and then 5 and 6 would come in and they would roll back as well. And then Dobbo and I also did the opposing low pass. And so basically after the bomb burst, we would come down and run head on at each other. I'd set the line and he would not hit me.
Right, right.
That's how that separation worked.
Yeah, I remember those manoeuvres. They both looked really quite spectacular.
Yeah. And I think Mitch coined the phrase the Caramello move for when PK and Herb were doing the crossover, the roll under brake, not the roll under brake, the crossover brake. The idea is to make the crowd gasp, but for it to be safe and sound in the meantime.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it must have been hard for you guys that were flying to actually get an appreciation of how the crowd were seeing it, how they were really appreciating it.
We had no idea of how the crowd was seeing it, really. We every display was videoed,
yep.
And we debriefed every display and also all of the practices. And so I guess one side that I hadn't really thought about or appreciated beforehand was really quite how boring the flying became.
Right.
So when we were in the depths of the team, you would get airborne, you would go out and you would run two practices, because each show only lasted about 15 minutes.
Yes, yeah.
And so normally we'd get airborne, we'd go out to Raumai, we'd have a loosen up, and then we would fly a display practice. When we finished that, we'd join in loose, have a talk about a few things on the radio at the time, say, right, you know, anyone got any problems, things I want to practice or things I want to look at, give it a run through again, and you go and land.
Right.
And so actually the difference between doing that and getting airborne at a show, there was little bit of added adrenaline and pressure because you know that you're on display.
Yeah.
But really, because you're not actually landing or dealing with the crowd, usually, there was very little difference.
Right,
and
right.
So you go and do your display and you come home and you land and you debrief it and you go home.
Right.
Sort of
okay.
Thing. So, that's why I say, certainly remember Hamilton and Invercargill particularly for that after experience.
Oh, right, okay. So when the horrible news came through that the strike wing was going to be abandoned or abolished,
yeah.
That must have been pretty gutting for you.
Oh, yeah, gutted.
Yeah.
Gutted covers it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that was a pretty awful moment. There was a lot of conflicted emotions and a lot of people, I think, and I really take my hat off to Nick Osborne, who was the CO at the time.
Yep.
Jason Easthope over in Australia. Obviously, after Muzzard crashed, he took over as the CO over there.
Yep.
Basically, the way that everyone from the pilots to the ground crews that were interviewed on TV and, you know, all of the drama that went with it, just how professionally everyone conducted themselves, no matter what they were feeling inside.
Yes. Absolutely.
And a lot of us were well conflicted at that stage.
In fact, I actually remember quite well that the public were talking about it a lot. You know, it's one of the big things in the news at the time, and everyone was disgusted at the whole concept of losing our air combat strike wing. It just seemed ridiculous. I remember seeing a poll on the television that said 90% of people wanted it to stay.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's not many things that get that sort of reaction. So, you know, it's been a huge loss to the Air Force, hasn't it?
I think so.
Yeah.
Personally, I think it has been a loss to the Air Force, and I think we're still dealing with some of the fallout from that. But equally, you know, we work in a democracy and we do as we're told, and
yes,
you know, you have to suck it up and get on with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So where did you move on to from Skyhawks? Because you're still in the Air Force now.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess it challenged my loyalty quite a bit, but I'm still here for want of something better to do, really. And basically, 2001, I was the Inspector General of the Air Force, and that's a ground job in Wellington.
Oh, yeah.
And then towards the end of 2003, the helicopter replacement project was coming along.
Right.
And I was really keen to get out of my my staff job and get back to something that was at least semi talking about aeroplanes.
Yes, yeah.
And so I sort of put my hand up for the helicopter project, and I guess it's a fair warning to everyone that you've got to be careful what you wish for, because 10 years later I'm still on it.
Okay.
Yeah. This is World Radio.
Hey, it's Matt from Warbird Radio Live. Listen, if you're trying to find something special for one of your aviation buddies, visit us online at warbirdradio.com/deals, D-E-A-L-S, warbirdradio.com/deals for some great offers from aviation memorabilia, just the cool stuff that all pilots will enjoy. You can find it at warbirdradio.com/deals. And remember, every dollar that you spend there on the deals page or even in through our Amazon store, which is on the right side of the screen there, it helps keep the station on the air. And boy, every penny helps, and we certainly appreciate your business. Warbirdradio.com/deals.
Jeff Harold here from Shaden Precision Eyewear. Shaden offers unmatched headset comfort with the best in titanium and composite frames and non-polarized lenses. Eyewear for the true aviator. Visit us online now at Shaden.com. That's Scheyden.com. Again, Scheyden.com. Be sure to enter the promo code Warbird, and you're going to receive 30% off your order. Visit Shaden.com right now. Put in Warbird and get 30% off.
Our thanks to our friends at Aerospace Specialties, the industry standard for quality, craftsmanship, and precision. When it comes to handcrafted compound-formed Warbird parts, look no further than our friends at Aerospace Specialties. They've been doing this since 1971, and they're standing by now for your order. Aerospace Specialties, call them today, 304-647-5024. That's 304-647-5024.
Reminding you that radio engines don't leak oil. They just mark their territory. This is Warbird Radio. Tune in. Take off.
Yeah, and just getting back to the Skyhawks, only a couple of weeks ago you were in the States watching the first of the Skyhawks that's flown again.
Yeah, look, I was very fortunate and in the right place at the right time and said yes when the question was asked. And so I got to go over to Lakeland, which is just out half an hour's drive east of Tampa, in Florida. So Tampa's on the west coast, on the Gulf of Mexico coast of the bit of Florida that sticks out.
Yes, yeah.
And Lakeland hosts annually the Fun and Sun air show, which apparently is second to Oshkosh in the United States.
Okay, yeah.
So if you imagine a sort of a fairly big air show, you've got an idea of what's going on.
Right.
The sort of thing we're talking about starts Tuesday, finishes Sunday, and there is flying day and night for the entire week.
Wow.
It is quite unbelievable.
Sounds awesome.
Except that, of course, this year with sequestration and various things going on in the States, there was not a single active military presence at all in the entire time.
Wow, that's stunning, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So Blue Angels, Thunderbirds sitting on the ground, they're talking about disbanding up to a third of their frontline squadrons. They've got some fairly serious financial constraints placed on them, which sort of vaguely familiar for some of the things that we've been dealing with.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
It's nice to see the jets flying again. So, long story short, we got over there a couple of weeks ago, and Draken International is the company that has purchased two TA-4s and six A-4s.
Yep.
And eight Mackies, and they're looking to put them back into service to conduct adversary training along the lines of exactly what we used to do at Two Squadron.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, and they just, I mean, you're talking about a bunch of guys who, the pilots have a Brazilian hours flying all sorts of F model aeroplanes from 104s to 14, 15, 16, 18, etc.
Yep.
So that there's no shortage of experience there. I was talking to one of the guys there, one of their senior pilots, and he was saying he's a fighter weapons school grad with something like 70 different aircraft types in his logbook.
Wow, that's a lot.
Been flying since he was 15 and has just flown everything. These guys fly the Black Diamonds aerobatic team, which is using the L-39 jet.
Yep, yep.
And so they do a very, very professional, incredible job of putting together a jet formation aerobatics display. And of course now with the Blue Angels and the Thunderbirds are not displaying. I don't think they've actually been disbanded, but they're certainly they're not conducting any public displays this year.
Yeah.
It means they're the only jet aerobatic team active in the United States.
Holy cow, that's so amazing.
It's quite special to see these guys perform, and it was even more special on Friday a couple of weeks ago where I actually got to sit in the back seat of the number two while they were doing a practice.
Brilliant.
Which was pretty cool because I never thought I'd get to do formation jet aerobatics again. And especially not quite as close as those guys fly.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it really was special.
How did the L-39 compare for you to what you used to fly with the A-4s? Was it?
Oh, look, the L-39 is it's definitely a jet trainer.
Yeah.
And even the not having flown the Mackie, apart from my hour of touring around in the back seat with Ricky Smits, but the L-39 is definitely a jet trainer. It runs out of puff when you get it into the vertical, which of course, if you know about formation aerobatics, is the thing that actually makes it challenging is avoiding the light buffet or the stall as you go over the top of the loop.
Yep.
And to maintain very tight, close formation as you go over the top of those sort of manoeuvres, you do have to be very, very careful.
Right.
And so the guys are particularly careful during the season. They have to fly at least once a week to maintain their currency.
Okay.
And they conduct a practice or you know, number of practices before each air show. Because obviously these guys, the pilots flying them are not full-time. They're busy flying freight for FedEx or, doing other piloting jobs.
Right, right.
Being corporate pilots and things like that. So they come together to put the team together. But even so, they have to fly every week to maintain their currency.
Right, okay. Well, that's amazing, eh?
With the A4, when you hit the, it just woke the whole of the place up. The J52 just makes a fantastic noise.
Oh, yeah.
And when there's a bunch of little piston aerobats that are whizzing around and Harvards and things like that, you know when the A4 is arced up and is powering down the runway, that's for sure.
Yeah, I can just imagine it.
Yeah, it brought a tear to the eye. There's a few Kiwis over there helping out, and there were a number there in the audience watching on. And
yep.
I guess, without doubt, everyone had a wee tear and just so pleased to see them flying again rather than being chucked into a shredder.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It's actually worked out quite well. A number of museums have got them, and we've still got some flying. So,
Draken are flying them in New Zealand colours as well, so they've retained their New Zealand camouflage. They have the American buzz numbers painted on the side, and they have the Draken International crest on the side of them, but they have actually retained the Kiwi camouflage. So the heritage day that they hosted on the Wednesday a couple of weeks ago was pretty special. These guys are really, really committed to maintaining the homage to the New Zealand heritage for these aircraft, both the A4 and the Mackie, which is really, really kind of cool.
That is brilliant. That's really good. Did you find the average American there kind of got it, though? Were they aware of what the RNZF is and that sort of thing?
Yeah, to be honest, didn't really get to talk to the average American.
Right.
Because we were pretty much flat out with the Draken guys.
Yeah, yep.
So my role over there in particular was talking to their pilots about the Kahu systems in the A4.
Yep.
And giving them some of the ins and outs on the how we used to work the Kahu system, because they've restored the aircraft to full operational capability. So they have the radar, laser ring gyro, the display units, the HOTAS, all of that is fully operable.
Yep.
So they're not talking about flying these things as warbirds, they're talking about doing many thousands of hours of fleet support, adversary support with these aircraft. And so, had the pleasure of sitting in the back seat of a jet again, which I haven't done for a few years, and, and tapping through the different pages in the display units and talking about radars and the ins and outs of the inertial nav and things like that. So that was a good opportunity to rack the old grey matter for some of that stuff that hasn't come to mind for a year or two.
Yeah. Do you think you're inspired now to maybe go and have a chat with some of the local jet owners and get into the warbird flying maybe?
Oh, look, I'd absolutely love to. First thing I've got to do is get my daughter through university, though, probably does. So. I'm sure some people listening will probably have a wee chuckle at that. But, yeah, maybe in a year or two.
Okay. Actually, were you at Wairarapa this year, at the Wings Over Wairarapa?
No, look, I wasn't. I didn't make the Wings Over Wairarapa, but I did get down to Omaka.
Yeah.
Okay. And I can, rest assured, the Omaka air show, absolutely international quality. Although, theoretically it's only 3 days long and it's in a little old place in the South Island, and it would seem to be a long way from the big shows like Oshkosh and Fun and Sun.
Yeah.
Having been at Fun and Sun and having been at the Omaka air show, I'd go back to Omaka any day of the week ahead of going to Fun and Sun.
Right.
The quality of the show and the variety of the aircraft was just spectacular. And so, people who I'm sure that some of the New Zealand audience going to Omaka have no idea just how lucky they are to have that quality of show on their doorstep.
Absolutely, I would agree with that. It's such a stunning air show. It's my favourite air show, favourite regular air show there is.
Yeah, I guess there's nothing worse than a convert. It's the first time I've been down there.
Oh, right.
I probably should have been before. And so I was certainly in that category of not knowing. Now that I know, get the word out, get down to Omaka. It's a great show.
Yeah, I guess we'll see you there next time then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Have you got any sort of final thoughts about the Skyhawk that you'd like to tell people, that maybe they don't know about the Skyhawk?
I guess the point needs to be made that this company has bought the Skyhawk and the Mackie to put into service in the United States to conduct adversary training against the modern US military forces. And I guess some of the rationale that was used for the decommissioning of the Skyhawks at the time was, a little misguided. These guys are going to provide an absolutely credible adversary training capability with the Skyhawk and the Mackie. When you see them flying again, they've still got it.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, that speaks volumes about those aircraft, doesn't it?
It really does. It's a classic aeroplane, and there aren't many classics, and the Skyhawk's one of them.
Yeah,
it's right up there with the DC-3, UH-1. It really, really is a classic that's just flown for years and years and keeps delivering.
Absolutely. That's very good. Well, thank you very much, Patch. It's been great to have a chat with you. And,
pleasure talking to you,
Dave. Yeah, great. I hope to catch you soon, or if not soon, then definitely at the next Omaka air show.
Yeah, would absolutely look forward to.
Cool.
All right.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Cheers, bye.
That was the Wings Over New Zealand show with Dave Homewood.
Reminding you that radio engines don't leak oil. They just mark their territory. This is Warbird Radio. Tune in. Take off.